input. We've reached item number 14, status of Washington sockeye salmon. This is a briefing and a public hearing. Commissioner Schmitten, did you want to say something? This was your blue sheet request. So you want to introduce this topic and tell us why it's particularly ironic that we have it today?
I'd like to do that. Well, let me just note that my comments should not be held against the staff or public time. I got a wake-up call at 7:08 this morning. My buddy's on Lake Wenatchee saying, "We're all limited. Where are you?" And I'm thinking, I know where I am. Wish I was with you. I want to start by thanking the staff in particular. There's a lot of effort goes into something like this, and noteworthy for Aaron DeVault, as I thumb through already the overheads, very, very well done, and it's appreciated. I'm old enough now, I'm approaching my 70th birthday, to have a little history on some fisheries, and I'm going to relate a history on the sockeye fishery, and I'll do it quickly. Because I've seen history being made. You know, and the fishery started in the 1880s on the Columbia River. It was beach seines, often pulled by horses. It was gill nets, and is for the canneries on both the Washington and Oregon side. Targeting Chinook and Coho, same time in the Puget Sound. Although there it was Chinook, Coho, pinks, and reds. Reds are sockeye salmon. Again, for canneries, again, exclusively, for all intents and purposes, commercial fisheries. There were some recreational fisheries, and it was started in the early 1900s and continued to increase. But these were all for canneries. And the reason for that, until the early 40s and you had dependable refrigeration, you didn't have fresh fish. They were good for 2-3 days. So about the 40s, things changed. Recreational interest perked up, and the recreational interest was on 4 species of Pacific salmon, sands, sockeye. I'm going to jump forward now to 1981. I was actually a commissioner in what was called the IPFSC, the International Pacific Salmon Commission. That was the forerunner of the Pacific Salmon Commission. And I remember a meeting specifically because that day we would rotate. We'd meet in Vancouver one time, meet in Bellingham all summer long, every week of the season for Fraser River, the Fraser River fishery, which we were a part of. That day when we got the biological report, for the first time I'd ever heard, they said, and we have at that point nearly 2,000 fish taken in the troll fishery, sockeye salmon. And I said, how did they do this? They've never taken them before. And then the guy says, on bare hooks. And I stood up and I said, I'm standing up because it's getting so deep in this room. I'm not sure I can believe this. But, I've always imagined how that occurred. You know, you just picture a troller out and, the outrigger, the bell goes off and they miss a fish and they're fishing exclusively kings and coho. And so they're bringing up the outrigger and a fish hits and they bring it in and deckhand says, "Hey, sockeye." You know, and the skipper probably said, "Wow, that's unusual." I'll throw it in the box, and happens again. And they begin to think, hey, the bait was gone. They used either the big plugs or used fresh herring. And it was a fresh herring hook, I'm sure. And these guys are not slow. Maybe not in fish issues, but a lot of other issues. And I could just see the skipper put them down 40 feet, no bait. First time they doubled up, and in fisheries there are no secrets. So, and that boat came in to either the tender or dockside, and he's got 100 plus fish, a sockeye that's never happened in history. That word goes up and down. So he won't tell except his one best friend. And he tells that best friend, who tells his best friend, who then gets over to Macaw Bay and our trollers. and now I'm believing it. Bear Hook, who can believe that? Still mystifies me. I suspect some troller who happened to recreational fish afterwards said, well, I wonder if I can do this recreational fishing. And he did. It's never going to be a big fishery in the Straits because those fish are moving too quick. They're bunched up, but they're racing through. Then it happened. I had moved into National Marine Fishery Service, and I was looking out my window at Lake Washington. And if you've heard the phrase, you could walk across the bay on boats, literally. Lake Washington had, easily 1,000 boats fishing on the first sockeye fishery. It was stunning. I had no idea the amount of, no one knew how really to do this very well, so they were buying all sorts of gear and it advanced, and I need to shorten my story, but into the upper, the other runs in interior Washington, the Brewster run last year, having a record 350 plus thousand. Where I live in front of my, I live on the water, just in front of my dock, is the main fishery in Lake Wenatchee that's going on right now. We shift to economics for a moment, then turn it over to the pros. We, in the Brewster fishery last year, when it was really going for 3 weeks, averaging about 200 boats a day, I sat down with a bunch of biologists. I said, let's do an exercise. Let's guess how much money is being spent. And we looked at gas, we looked at travel, we looked at lodging, we looked at license, we looked at a $1,250 endorsement fee for every boat that was out there. And we figured that every 4 days was $1 million. Now you're talking three or four little towns that literally roll up the concrete in October. They lived Terrace, Brewster, Bridgeport. I'll throw in that mix, Methow, Twist, and Winthrop, but for a different species. They lived on a few tourist dollars in the apple industry, which is over in October. They were dead until next May. Suddenly, this, with a steelhead fishery developing, with springers and summers developing, now you've got a mix of sockeye developing, new hotels are springing up, restaurants are springing up. The economic life that's been breathed into that area is amazing. So I think about the end. Final note, why sockeye? To me, it's a perfect size fish. If you're going to barbecue a fish, it has the color you want to epitomize as a salmon, fluorescent red. Made for the barbecue, not too thick, cooks easy. That's why sockeye. They've held their value. And part of the reason for asking for this hearing is the mystery of sockeye. Literally, we don't know a whole lot about sockeye. Why did we have these robust boom fisheries and then taper off down to barely enough to eke by? We never had two sockeye fisheries in a row in my life at Lake Wenatchee, and I fished the first one about in 91, 2, 3, somewhere in there. We're on our third fishery in a row. We will probably be in the 40,000 again, need 23 for escapement. We had 60 last year, biggest one in history. So those are the mysteries that I hope we can talk a little bit about. And again, not from an old guy, thank all of you that really know what's going on, and we'll hear a lot about it. Thanks, Chair.
Well, I don't know about anybody else, but I sure enjoyed that long story. The guy has been around for a long time. He's like one of our elders, and I didn't know any of that. So great recapitulation of the history. Commissioner Carpenter.
Well, I want to thank Mr. Schmidt for his commentary. In my regular life, as someone in the boat business, that I do business with all sectors, with recreational, commercial, and tribal fisheries, the difference in activity and opportunity to be profitable when we have sockeye fisheries in the region are just, you can't measure them. I mean, it's like a magic fish. when the sockeye are available, people come from everywhere. They drop what they'll quit fishing Chinook salmon. They'll go fish sockeye. It just adds a different level of incredible enthusiasm to the public's mindset. So I appreciate Commissioner Smith bringing this issue forward, and I know Aaron has some magic to share with us.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Okay, let's get going with the presentation.
And Kyle.
Kyle and Aaron, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson. I'm Kyle Laddix with the Director's Office. With me is Aaron Dufault with the Fish Program. He's our Pink Chum Sockeye Species Specialist. He's also the department's representative to the Fraser River Panel Technical Committee. He's put together what I hope will be an informative presentation for you. He's one of our newer biologists. He's been with us just over a year, but he's learned a lot. I have some history in the same issue, so I'm up here to give him some moral support and help him answer questions.
Okay.
Aaron?
Great.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson, as he said, my name is Aaron Dufault, and it's been a good time of the last year, and hopefully I'll share a little bit about what I've learned. Start off with a quick outline. We'll cover sockeye biology, general life history, distribution, a little bit on survival, and then we'll kind of go step by step through a couple of the major sockeye stocks in the state. This is by no means all of them, but we're going to cover Snake River and then Fraser River up actually in Canada, and then Lake Washington, Baker Lake, Lake Wenatchee, and then Lake Osoyoos or Okanagan River. And then we'll try to tie things together with a summary of those stocks and then a little bit about increasing opportunity for sockeye fisheries in the state. So the distribution of sockeye, at least in the Western North America, goes all the way from, I guess I can use my pointer here, from the Columbia River all the way up to Western Alaska. And the unique thing about sockeye compared to the other sockeye species is their use of juvenile rearing in lakes. Immediately upon emergence from the gravel with fry, they migrate directly to the lake. And when these fry are migrating, they're the smallest relative to any other salmonid species upon emergence. And when you're a juvenile fry, size is everything. The smaller you are, the more mouths you can essentially fit into. So sockeye essentially spend a year or two in a lake to increase in size so they can make it to the increase in size before they make it to the marine environment. So hopefully their survival is increased because of that. And when you actually do look at the data for juvenile survival, both fry to from egg all the way to smolt, sockeye have the highest survival relative to the other species. So this lake rearing is critical for their survival. And then depending on how many years they spend in the freshwater, they return as anywhere from age 3 to 5 year old fish. So that's anywhere from 1 to 4 years in the actual ocean. So at these different life history stages, there's a lot of different factors that are affecting their survival. And I'll try to summarize these relatively briefly. So with the freshwater, there's a couple different environmental factors, flooding events and drought, which can scour the surface, or excuse me, scour the river and potentially remove the eggs from the river. Temperature, sedimentation, as you guys know, in all of these, anthropogenic effects on the river can have huge effects on all of these. Sedimentation, so if sediment's going downriver, you can actually limit the amount of oxygen these eggs can take up, and so you can kill the eggs in that way. Eutrophication is another situation that happens in lakes like Lake Washington historically. Biological factors, predation, disease, food availability, especially that food availability in those rearing lakes. And then a huge one for Columbia River fish is dam fish passage, and we'll get into that quite a bit later. While they're in the marine environment, there's a little less going on, but ocean conditions play a large role in this, and mostly indirectly through changes to food availability for the particular salmonid species. They are still susceptible to predation, but less so than when they're smaller. Excuse me, get a drink of water real quick. This is just a very generalized map of the ocean migration of sockeye. We don't have an amazing amount of data speaking to this, but this is specifically for Fraser sockeye, but the same holds true for our Washington stocks as well. So essentially, as they migrate out their lakes into the marine environment, they go up the coast into the Gulf of Alaska and then actually into the open ocean where their feeding grounds are. So I'll cover the quick sockeye stocks, the regional sockeye stocks, and these are all the majority of them, not just the ones I'll talk about for this talk. So we have Lake Ozette, and this is going from coastal to inland. The Quileute River, Lake Quinault, and then we have the Fraser River up in Canada, Lake Washington, and Baker Lake. And then moving up the Columbia, we have the Snake River, Lake Wenatchee, and then Okanagan River or Lake of Soyuz. And as I said, the Fraser River, Baker Lake, Lake Wenatchee, Lake Washington, and Lake of Soyuz are the stocks I'll be focusing on for this talk. So before I jump into individual stocks, there's a few things we can say about regional trends that are acting on, theoretically, all of these stocks. There was a pretty well-known paper in 2012 by Peterman and Dorner, and they documented some decreasing productivity of southern sockeye stocks since 2000. And by southern, it's basically southeast Alaska all the way down to us, not western Alaska. And this is using data from 1950 through 2008. And interestingly, during this time, western Alaskan stocks showed very opposite trends. They were doing much better during this time. And they don't really speak to that, but it's an interesting point to make. What they didn't really get into was the causes of the decline. They were more looking at just documenting a widespread decline amongst all these stocks. But a previous paper by this same author identified the key life history stage that they thought was the limiting factor here in causing these decreased productivity trends, and that was specifically in that smolt to adult life history phase. So this is not when they're in the freshwater. This is when they're in the marine environment. Essentially, we have less impact on them than their rearing lakes or the streams that are around us. So they didn't really have a definitive causal relationship there, but it speaks to potential for ocean conditions causing changes to food availability, which could cause decreases in productivity in the ocean. So we're going to jump into the Snake River. I'm going to just talk very briefly about the Snake River. I know many of you are very intimately knowledgeable about sockeye returning to the Snake. In 1991, Snake River sockeye were listed under the Endangered Species Act, and this is very apparent following this lower Granite Dam counts. So these are sockeye returning to the Snake, and you can see 1991 is here, and during those time periods in the few years prior, you're getting single-digit returns. There's years where they had two fish. Most of you are probably aware of the story of Lonesome Larry to Redfish Lake, and Idaho Fish and Game has a really cool PR campaign where they send a guy out in a sockeye suit, and so you have all these pictures of him going to these kind of historical sites, and here he's on one of the major dams that was removed on the Snake. So the huge success with Snake River is the captive broodstock program there. They basically took a stock with, you know, two fish returning on given years and turned it around, so now in the last couple years, you're getting upwards of 1,000, even over 2,000 fish in 2010. So by no means is it reaching historical levels, but relative to the two fish you had in those years, it's a huge increase and a huge success for all the effort that was put in there. Going to jump into Fraser River. This is a picture of Hell's Gate. It's a very narrow passage in the Fraser River system, and I'll talk about that in just a second here. This is a schematic, or a map, excuse me, of the Fraser River watershed. And the first thing to note is that the size and magnitude of this watershed is huge relative to a lot of the sockeye runs I'll talk about in our state. And each of these individual red lakes here is an actual individual rearing lake. So there's you could have an incredibly long presentation on this alone. So I'm barely going to touch the surface. It is predominantly a natural run. There's very limited broodstocking or artificial propagation in the system. Another well-known historical event was the Hell's Gate slide in 1913. This is essentially when this slide happened. It limited basically all upstream movement of all salmonid species at this point. Shortly thereafter, Canadians realized this, and they actually removed all the debris 2 years later. And then shortly after, again, this is a really narrow passage, and the water is going through there very quick. And so the U.S. and Canada worked in conjunction and built some fish ladders to enhance fish passage over this area. And right after this, the International Pacific Salmon Fisheries Commission, which Commissioner Schmitten was speaking to, was founded. Currently, it's called the Pacific Salmon Commission. And so this fishery is managed jointly between the U.S. and Canada with the Pacific Salmon Commission. This is, I think you could argue, this is perhaps the most intensively managed salmon fishery in the world. Being on the Fraser panel for the last year, the learning curve is a little bit higher than this job even. There's an amazing amount of information going into making these decisions, and it's kind of a marvel to experience. So these are Fraser River run sizes. I'll point out a few key things here. On the y-axis here, we have run size, and the first thing you'll notice here relative to when I get into the other stocks is the magnitude of these run sizes. You're upwards of 20 million fish in some years, which is unheard of in our recent history. And the other thing to point out is that from year to year, there's incredible variability. Just as Commissioner Schmitten was speaking to, that on a single year, you could have a low run size. The very next year, you could have very high run sizes. For this talk, there's this slight decrease that you notice here, but what isn't apparent here is the productivity of Fraser River sockeye during that time period was actually declining relatively, or actually quite a bit. It's not really apparent in their total run size, but the actual productivity of the stocks was declining. And I'll speak to this more, but in 2008, due to low runs, they commissioned what ended up being called the Cohen Commission, which was basically a formal inquiry into determining what the cause of the decline in productivity. And the interesting thing to point out is this 2010 graph, which I'll speak to in a second. So looking into Fraser River fisheries, it is managed as a natural stock, and as far as for U.S. fisheries, it has commercial priority. And these are catches from 1990 to 2010. And you can see catches upwards of 2 million in some years. And then this is on those very low run size years. Over the period of 1990 to 2010, average catch was approximately 730,000 sockeye per year. This is both treaty and non-treaty, so state and tribal. And the ex-vessel value for 2000 to 2010 is approximately almost $3 million averaged over each year. So a little bit more on the Fraser River Cohen Commission. So again, it was decreased sockeye productivity that led to the Cohen Commission, and the goal was ultimately to determine the cause of decline and see if they could turn those current decreasing productivity trends around. And then again, as this commission is undergoing, they have the largest return they've had in 100 years, essentially. And so that point alone really speaks to the variability that some of these stocks are experiencing on a year-to-year basis. And the findings of the Cohen Commission, they found that there was no smoking gun, that one causal factor that was leading to the decline, that there was numerous local and regional stressors that were likely contributing to this. What they also found or concluded was that mismanagement was not a cause of the decline, and that they did identify key life stages with knowledge gaps for fisheries managers to pursue to help manage, but management itself was not the cause here. So moving on to Lake Washington, this is a picture from 2004, and you can see the enormous number of boats in this one part of the lake fishing for sockeye. Most people are aware that as far as sockeye fisheries in our state, this is probably the one that garners the most public interest. and most of you are probably aware where that is in central Puget Sound, but the key point to I wanted to make here is that obviously this is surrounded entirely by urban environment. So out of all of the sockeye fisheries we'll talk about, these fish are returning to a lake that's completely surrounded by developed areas. So a little bit on the history of Lake Washington. Back when it was Department of Fisheries, they introduced sockeye from Baker from 1934 to 1944. There was likely a remnant population in the lake prior to that, but there's some contradictory evidence speaking to that. So there was likely a run, but not on the scale of anything that was before introduction. And what made the introductions possible was the diversion of Cedar River into the lake, as well as the construction of the Ballard Lock. So this is an old map of the southern end of the lake, and this is the lake here, and it actually emptied out into the Black River, which emptied into the Duwamish, and the Cedar River actually entered straight into the Black. So they diverted the Cedar River into Lake Washington. This was primarily for flood control at the time, and then when the locks were constructed and the lake level dropped, that outlet that was at the Black River essentially dried up. So at that point, the Lake Washington Ship Canal and the locks became the only outlet of the lake. So the hydrology of that area of the lake and probably the lake as a whole was fundamentally changed by that particular diversion of the Cedar River. So at this point, it made the lake suitable for lake rearing. Previously, the fish, if they were to make it to the lake, they need a stream emptying into the lake to spawn into. So at this point, the Cedar, which is now emptying into Lake Washington, becomes a suitable spawning habitat. A little bit more on the history. So again, they were introduced in the late or mid-30s and 40s. By the 1960s, there was some significant returns occurring. By 1960, there's approximately 25,000 fish returning. These escapements increased through the 1960s. And then we had the first fisheries again in the 1970s. And the spawning is primarily currently on the Cedar River and then in the northern end of the lake in Bear Creek as well, but the majority of the production is in the Cedar River. So for Lake Washington run sizes, we use locks counts as the main historical way to determine those run sizes. And as you can see throughout the years, this goes from 1972 all the way to 2012. Early on, we had run sizes, again, very variable on a year-to-year basis, but upwards of 200,000. And the escapement goal that was determined far before my time was 350,000, and that's to the Cedar River. And essentially how it's been treated through the years is that once 350,000 fish pass the locks, what's over that is considered harvestable surplus, and that's what fisheries are based off of. And you can see in the more recent history, we had some much lower run sizes than what we had in the 70s and 80s. So a little bit on the fisheries. This is managed as a mixed stock currently with both artificial and natural production. Commission policy has recreational priority for this stock, but if the share were to grow greater than 200,000, that's when commercial fisheries would actually be performed on this stock. And this is total harvest for both treaty and non-treaty. And the dark blue bars are years when the state had a fishery as well. These lighter blue bars was actually low-level CNS fisheries by the tribes. And the average from 1972 to 2012, on average, we've had about a fishery every 30% of the time, almost every 3 years. That's decreased since 1990 to present at approximately just a little over 20%. During those years where we do have harvest, the average is 110,000 catch over that time period. So it's quite a bit larger than, say, Baker or Lake Wenatchee, which I'll speak to in a couple minutes. And the 2006 recreational fishery was estimated at $3.7 million, and this is basically taking a standard unit of effort for the fishery and multiplying it by essentially a willingness to pay of any recreational fisherman to go out. And we can speak to that more at the end if you'd like. So a couple key improvements for Lake Washington. There was an interim cedar hatchery, which started in 1991. It had a 17 million egg take capacity. And this hatchery was built because the Landsberg Dam, which you guys heard a little bit about in the public comments, which limited spawning habitat on the Cedar River, essentially blocked all fish passage upstream of that. So this was essentially to help mitigate that loss in habitat, so to increase the production coming from the Cedar River. The improved Cedar River hatchery was finalized in 2011. This basically doubled the egg take capacity at 34 million. And additionally, the lake has, over the years since the 50s and 60s and 70s, has undergone amazing water quality improvements through in the lake. And then at this time, as Frank spoke to a little bit, co-managers are reassessing the management framework around Lake Washington sockeye, and we can speak more to that in a little bit. A couple of the key challenges that Lake Washington has. Lake productivity is probably the largest at this point in time. In 2009, a commission report by WDF, an independent commission report requested from WDFW, highlighted that lake productivity was a bottleneck for the system, that we don't really know how many fish the lake can support, and the number that they concluded was quite a bit lower than the 34 million egg take capacity. So there's some differing opinions on this work, but it's a really key thing to be aware of. Again, urban development is a huge drawback here. This is the most urban out of our sockeye stocks. And then the lox counts, what I didn't speak to earlier is the lox counts potentially have huge errors involved in them. Fish, we count fish as they're moving through the lox, but what we don't count is some fish make it back down through the lox. If they come into the fresh water and encounter very warm water, they aren't enthused about that, so they sometimes can turn right back around and go back out. And so sometimes our values can be inflated. And on any given year, the difference between what we have at the locks versus what shows up on spawning grounds can be enormous, 30, 40, sometimes up almost to 50% difference from what shows up there to what shows up on the spawning ground. So ground truthing those and getting those more accurate is a crucial step. And we also don't have really robust estimates for in-lake survival. You would think after this time, it's actually very hard to, we don't have a smolt capture on the way out there through the ship canal or anything. So quantifying the in-lake survival estimates is also a huge step we need to make. So moving on to Baker Lake. This is in the north, northwestern part of the state. And it's kind of dark here, but Baker Lake is right here. And then there's actually Lake Shannon down below, which I'll speak to as well. So a little bit on Baker Lake history. There was a native sockeye population and run in Baker Lake. This run was blocked to some degree by the Lower Baker Dam in 1925. There was a ladder for fish passage, and this dam created Lake Shannon, that lower lake at that point. In 1959, there was an Upper Baker Dam that was finished, and then this enlarged Baker Lake, which was already there, but additionally it blocked upstream fish passage completely. So from that time, this fishery is entirely dependent on human transport of adults up to the lake and smolts down from the lake into the Baker River. And it is, at this point in time, a very hatchery-dependent run. We do have artificial spawning beaches as well, and there's a small amount of low-level natural production in the lake and in Baker River. So looking at recent history of Baker Lake run sizes. So again, run size on the y-axis, and this goes from 1992 to 2012. And this first value here is an average of the previous 30 years. So very small returns during that time, averaging a little bit under 2,500 fish. And what you can see over the last probably 3, 4, 5, even 6 years is that we've had some really good increases in run sizes. And the largest was actually last year, which topped out a little over 47,000 fish. We don't have an escapement goal per se in Baker Lake, but we do have brood stocking needs and a small amount of natural fish that we put up. And when you add up the brood stocking needs along with test fishery catches, you get about 8,100 fish is what you need to just break even on brood stocking and the artificial spawning beaches. A little bit on the fisheries. Again, this is predominantly a hatchery stock and it's managed as such. And the commission policy has recreational priority for this stock. And when you look at recreational harvest from 2000 to 2012, you can see 2010, 11, and 12 have some very high recreational harvest relative to the previous history. In 2010, that was the first Baker Lake fishery. So this was a large part of why this you see this large increase in trend. And then on 2012, the reason I've have a little asterisk here is there is the first Skagit River fishery on this stock. So that's additionally why the catch is so high there. The river fishery was very productive and had a lot of success for anglers. Prior to this, the fishery was kind of at the mouth of the Baker River where it meets the Skagit. Over the last 3 years, average harvest is approximately 7,000 fish, and we've estimated that at approximately $746,000 per year from 2010 to 2011. The data from 2012 isn't yet available. So some key improvements for Baker Lake. In 2008, they basically improved and had the floating surface collector, which is basically increases smolt capture efficiency. So prior to this, they did have a smolt capture device, I guess you can say, but it was not as efficient as this is. So this increased the number of smolts getting past the dam down into Baker River. Additionally, the hatchery there was updated in 2012, which upped the capacity to 11 million fry. And they also instituted artificial spawning beaches. And then the Baker trap, which you can see a picture of here, was also updated in 2012, and this greatly increased their fish handling abilities, sampling abilities for the fishery as well. So some key challenges for Baker Lake. We really have no idea what the lake rearing capacity is for smolts. As we're increasing smolt production, fry production, and fish are going into the lake, we'll likely figure some more about this relatively quickly here. But we really have no idea what the lake rearing capacity is. And as I said, we have some natural production, some fish from artificial spawning beaches, some from brood stock. We don't really know which particular stock is contributing most to the fishery. So identifying that would also be very helpful for management. And just general data needs for management. This is the recreational fishery is the extreme terminal end of this run. There's fisheries throughout the Skagit River by the tribes, and coming up with essential information to get quality in-season updates so we can schedule fisheries accordingly or curtail them if need be is crucial. Moving on to Lake Wenatchee. Again, some of you are intimately aware with this. This is Lake Wenatchee and following the Wenatchee River up from the Columbia. A little bit of the history of Lake Wenatchee. This is a native run, but did have introductions from Quinault River fish as well as fish that were captured at Grand Coulee from the late 30s to early 40s. Prior to that, in 1909, the Tumwater Dam was built on the Wenatchee River and was only remained open for a short number of years, but ultimately the powerhouse and everything with that river wasn't taken out until 1956. In 1998, Tumwater Dam counts started, and this is crucial because prior to that, estimating the run size in Lake Wenatchee, we basically took the counts at an upstream dam and the counts at a lower stream dam, and the difference, we said that's the Lake Wenatchee run size. So it was very, there's a lot of error involved with it. Spawning is on the Little Wenatchee, the White, and the Napiqua rivers. So with Lake Wenatchee run sizes, these are Tumwater Dam counts. Again, this is only from 1999 to 2012. Prior to that, you can't really compare the estimates, and so I'm only going to speak to the Tumwater Dam counts here. But as you can see, there is variability from year to year, but a little more stable than some of our other stocks. Again, we are looking at a shorter time period here. For this stock, there's a 23,000 escapement goal. And for fisheries, it's managed as a natural stock with recreational priority. And on average, over the last 20 plus years or so, there's fisheries approximately every 2 years, which is the most consistent fishery relative to our others at this point in time over this time period. Average harvest per year when we have fisheries is approximately 4,800 fish. And we've estimated that at $173,000 average economic value on any given year. And this is based solely off of fisheries in 2004, 2008, and 2009. So some key changes to management for Lake Wenatchee. Lake Wenatchee did have a hatchery that historically produced sockeye salmon. Their goal was 200,000 fry per year. However, due to poor returns from those hatchery stocks, it was first cut in half to 100,000 and then ultimately phased out. And so now it's entirely a natural productivity in the system. Some key challenges for Lake Wenatchee. There is confined spawning habitat on those rivers. Especially the White River, it's very prone to large flooding events and sediment coming downriver, which has limited the available spawning habitat to the lower parts of the river at this point. There's also additionally, just as I talked to, some differences between what shows up at Lake Washington with a locks count and what shows up on the spawning grounds. A similar situation shows up with Lake Wenatchee here, where what we count at Tumwater Dam doesn't always necessarily show up on a spawning ground and what we account for fisheries. So there's potentially some large pre-spawn mortality in the river or in the lake before they get to the spawning grounds. And again, just as all Columbia River stocks, a huge challenge for them is passage through the Columbia River Dam system. There's been some huge improvements increasing fish passage, but it's still a huge hurdle to overcome, both for downstream migration of smolt and upstream return as adults. And there is some fisheries management in the main stem Columbia, which is a challenge for this fishery. These fish are well known to be some of the larger sockeye, and they may be more susceptible to some of the tribal gillnets in the system, but that's another key challenge for this stock. Moving on to Lake Osoyoos and Okanagan River. For those of you who don't know, Lake Osoyoos, which is right here, actually is on both sides of the border, and there's a couple different lakes in that system upstream of Lake Osoyoos. There's Skaha Lake right here, and then Lake Okanagan as well up here. So the Canadians have undergone some very intensive work improving water quality in the system. They've invested a lot in new infrastructure and have limited the amount of nutrients going into the lake. They had a big eutrophication issue prior to that. And I'm not sure if you guys are aware, eutrophication, a lot of nutrients go into a closed body of water, and ultimately this can lower dissolved oxygen rates, increase algal growth, and it's a very fundamentally different system when you have a eutrophic lake. So they also had undergone some extensive reintroduction and habitat improvements for both Lake Osoyoos as well as Skaha Lake. They've removed some irrigation dam, opening up for their spawning habitat. They've also had a program for about 6 years now, I guess, that they've been introducing sockeye into Lake Skaha. And then there's also been modifications to the McIntyre Dam, allowing further fish access to the Okanagan River that's above Lake Osoyoos. So they've been iteratively opening up more spawning habitat, making more progress for this system. Looking at the run sizes, this goes from 1977 all the way to 2012. And the key highlight here is in 2008 to 2012, we had some very notable increases in run size. And there's the number of fish that we think need to be into the system is approximately 65,000 to meet escapement needs. And this run comprises the bulk of Columbia River sockeye runs at this current time. So a little on the fisheries. Again, this is managed as a mixed stock. There is artificial production in the system with recreational priority. U.S. fisheries occur in the Columbia River main stem. And over from 2010 to 2012, just over those 3 years, we've had an average harvest of 8,600 fish. But as you can see in 2012, with that very large run size, they had upwards of 25,000 fish caught. And these fish are actually they're actually targeted while Chinook fisheries are also occurring on the main stem Columbia. And this is estimated from 2010 to 12 at $725,000 per on average per year. So some key improvements that will be made to the system. I've already talked about some that have been made. They are putting a new hatchery in Penticton to be finished in 2014. This will have an 8 million egg take capacity, and the goal from these fish is to supply them to all of the both Skaha, Lake of Soyuz, and Okanagan. Some key challenges for this system, again, Columbia River dams. This is farther upstream than Wenatchee, and to get all the way into Lake of Soyuz, they have to pass 10 different dams to get there. So, again, a huge hurdle to overcome. There is further work being planned to open up Skaha Lake and Okanagan, despite what the Canadians have already done. And high water temperatures coming both in Lake of Soyuz and coming down the Okanagan River, and how that plays in a pre-spawn mortality. There's been some years where potential high pre-spawn mortality because of that high temperature. So I'm just going to summarize a few key points about those stocks. For Snake River, there was a huge captive broodstock program, which had a huge success on that system, ultimately saved it from extinction, we think. With Fraser, the run sizes are drastically higher than the majority of our stocks, all of our stocks, and this is the only one that has commercial fisheries by the state on it. And we talked about the Cohen Commission and the results from that. Lake Washington, again, it's an introduced run. It is a highly urban lake, and we really don't know what the smolt carrying capacity of the lake is at this point in time. With Baker, it is a hatchery-dependent run, and over the last couple years, we've had drastic increases to recreational opportunity on those fish. For Lake Wenatchee, there is potential for limited spawning habitat in that system, and it is the most consistent fishery over the last 20 years relative to these main ones I'm referring to. And with Okanagan or Lake of Soyuz fish, this is the bulk of the Columbia River return at this point, and spawning and lake rearing is entirely in Canada, and habitat and water quality improvements the Canadians have done some extensive habitat water quality improvements in that system. So how can we increase opportunity on some of these stocks? For Fraser River, it is a commercial prioritized stock at this point in time. If that were to change, just as Commissioner Schmidt spoke to, that we could develop more recreational opportunities or techniques to harvest those fish. It's not as, from what I've been told, that there's a little bit, catching sockeye in the salt has not been as successful historically as it has been in freshwater. So we can potentially develop some new techniques to get the public on board with that if need be. With Lake Washington, we are currently reassessing the management framework of that system, and we will continue to do studies to determine the optimum hatchery practices to maximize output from the hatchery and with the lake rearing capacity limitations. With Lake Wenatchee, at this point in time, probably the single most limiting factor that we could potentially restore is the spawning habitat in both the White and the Little Wenatchee rivers. With Baker Lake, we don't know the smolt carrying capacity of that lake. We have explored releasing some of those fish into Lake Shannon, which isn't currently being done. So you potentially have another lake that could support more fish if we reach the carrying capacity of Baker Lake. And with Okanagan and Lake of Soyuz, support Canadian enhancement efforts, as well as potential to develop new fishing areas and techniques in that system. And with that, I'd like to thank a lot of people that helped me get here, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
That was super.
Thank you.
That was really excellent, wasn't it, Commissioner Mencken?
Yeah, having been involved in sockeye restoration in the Pacific Northwest, I must say that was a very nice presentation. Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions for
you. Sure.
One is, it seems to me that 350,000 fish escapement is fairly large for spawning habitat in Lake Washington. As you were going through your presentation, I was looking at escapement numbers, or, you know, proposed escapement numbers for other systems. Maybe I missed it, but it looked to me like 350,000 was fairly high for Lake Washington.
I may have Kyle speak to the historical context here, and then I can jump in with the recent stuff.
It's hard to compare between watersheds because every watershed is so different. The 350,000 goal for Lake Washington's been around since the 70s, and a lot of people have said they think it's too high. Aaron spoke to the Woody and McPherson paper that was commissioned by the agency to look at that issue to see, is there a different way we should be managing Lake Washington? And they identified a sort of a decline in productivity that started sometime in the 80s in the lake. They compared Lake Washington to some other systems and concluded that it's a much less productive system than those other systems. And they identified some fry numbers and adult spawner numbers that might be reasonable for the system as it currently exists. And the co-managers have been reviewing the data. The agencies looked hard at what Woody and McPherson have recommended. The co-managers are not as interested in looking at that, but are very interested in looking at the data. We've had a lot of technical discussions and identified some potential different management thresholds to use lower than that 350,000. There's still a lot of discussions to occur before that would get implemented, but we're moving down that road. So, yeah, the data do seem to suggest that 350 might not be the right number.
Yeah, that, I've heard that. Another question that I have for you is on the Fraser, the Canadians have been using spawning channels, and I remember controversy as to whether the spawning channels were truly working for the BC people. Have we considered in the new era the use of spawning channels in addition to the use of hatcheries for a place, for example, like Lake Wenatchee to expand spawning habitat?
I don't know that we have recently. I think it was back in the late 80s that I think the legislature actually identified money to build a spawning channel on the Cedar. And I'm not real clear on the history of why that never happened and they went the hatchery route instead. I'm not too familiar with the long-term success of the Canadian channel. Some of them are still in operation. A lot of them aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some different risks to putting a bunch of fish in a spawning channel like
sure.
that as opposed to letting them spawn.
Sure.
It would make sense in a system like the Cedar where it's more prone to flood flows and scouring and that sort of thing as opposed to the Fraser systems, which are a little more stable during the spawning and incubation mm-hmm. period. But it's been a while since we've looked at that.
Thank you. Good presentation.
Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle and Aaron, I much, much appreciated your presentation. And the other folks listed on there, I want to thank them as well. You answered a lot of questions, both of you. I have three, and I'm just going to throw them all at you once, and you can answer them any order you want. What do you know about high seas interception of the sockeye stocks that you spoke of, firstly? And you mentioned on the Baker 8,100 needed in the lake. How many do we have there currently this year? And as Lake Shannon supports a very robust kokanee stock, why couldn't we introduce sockeye smolts into Lake Shannon as well as Baker Lake to enhance that opportunity?
On Lake Shannon, I'm not sure if we've actually started releasing some fry into Lake Shannon. I know it went into the future brood document a year or two ago, and the intent was to start doing that. I don't know if we have started that yet, but it is something that's definitely being explored.
If I may, just a second. I understand there's a gulper that's either built or being constructed at Lake Shannon currently, so I assume that that's going forward. Is that fair?
I would assume so. I'd have to check with some of the region four staff and confirm.
Yeah.
The high seas interception issue, I'm not too up on the history there. I know the general belief is it's not the problem that it might have been in the past. A lot of that went on well before my time, but
sure.
I don't believe it's a problem currently. And sorry, your second question.
Well, the last one was the
current.
How many sockeye do we have in Baker Lake currently trucked up and released?
As far as the number that have been released in the lake, or the total number that we've, I guess, encountered this year at the trout.
Numbers that have been released in the lake versus what our goal is.
Oh, so that goal, 1,500 of those fish are for natural spawning purposes. Then the remainder above that, just as you're probably aware, but just so everybody's on the same page, are surplus fish for the lake fishery. And just as Steve was pointing out to me, there's just under 5,500 fish that have been put into the lake currently. There's still, there's a lot more fish than that that have been taken at the trap that have been put into brood stocking or those artificial spawning beaches, and they take it over that entire the whole range of the run, so they don't take everything right up front. They take it as the run comes in. So at this point in time, we haven't finished filling brood stocking needs and artificial spawning, but that's because they take it over the whole entire run. But so there's 5,500 fish essentially in the lake right now for the fishery.
So we're short about 2,700 fish
for our share. Is that referring to, or no? So this isn't this 5,500 is only fish going into the lake for that would that 1,500 for natural spawning comes off of that additional fish. So if there's 5,500 in the lake, there's approximately 3,000 fish that essentially would be thought of as the recreational share. That's what the lake is fishing on. I don't recall what the total number accounted for to date, what's been, but it's, I don't think we should have issue making brood stocking and artificial, and filling the artificial spawning beaches this year.
But we potentially have a shortage of recreational opportunity based on the fish in the lake, am I correct?
Correct.
Director Anderson?
On that topic, I just wanted to explore that a little bit more. I think our preseason forecast was like 21,500.
Correct.
And our in-season update is 18,000. Is that correct? And we've had some tribal fisheries occur. Those have been closed. And the one that was done by the Swinomish.
Yep.
And there was at the beginning of the return period, we had some low numbers of fish showing up at the trap, which was initially a cause for concern as to whether we were going to make our brood stock needs or not. That trend has improved, so that we've been making our weekly brood stock needs, is my understanding.
Yes, that's correct.
And so as a result, that's your last statement there, that you believe that we're going to be able to meet our brood stock needs, is in part what that's based on.
Yeah, there was, just as you spoke to, there was a period of time where meeting that those brood stocking needs was in question. Over the last couple of weeks, we've met our weekly goals for brood stocking needs, so it appears we won't have an issue.
And then the other point, with the reduction from the preseason forecast of 21,500 down to 18,000, everybody, including the tribes, is going to have to reduce their fisheries a little bit from what was planned preseason. Is that correct?
That is correct, and just because generally in the lower river they fish to the preseason schedule, because a lot of those, if we, by the time we have enough data to update the run, those fish have passed a lot of those areas, and so when you downgrade the run and we're the extreme terminal fishery, you can have some situations where some share discrepancy arises. So it was downgraded, and they did curtail their fisheries when we downgraded the run.
Thanks.
Commissioner Kehoe?
Yes. Thanks, Madam Chair. Aaron, very nice presentation. I do think we should have this presentation at the Fraser panel. I think there would be a lot of interest in it, and so I'll mention something to Mike LaPointe about it. And I know Aaron spoke about the Fraser panel. I've been fortunate enough to be part of the process now 12 years, hard to believe. And I've learned a lot about sockeye, and it's been a great experience. I know I've mentioned this to the director and to Pat several times in the past. We're very fortunate to have Kyle and Aaron, and I see Steve Teasfeld in the room, and then John prior to that serving, representing Washington on the Fraser panel. They do a great job, and I know this is a busy time of year, but and it, the travel can be very tough this time of year, but we really appreciate it, and they do a great job. And then I know we're up to 9:45, but I have another comments and some questions. Speaking of Lake Washington, I'm not a recreational angler, but I live in Ballard, very close to the locks, and I can say that from a viewing perspective, wildlife viewing, it's truly an amazing place. And if you go to the locks this time of year, earlier, 4th of July, I mean, it's there's people from all over the country and all over the world, and such an amazing environment. You can take a bus from downtown Seattle 20 minutes and then be and see this amazing spot, and it I think that's a huge part as well. And Aaron, you mentioned the run passage, kind of the difficulties in estimating that. You know, there's, as you know, a lot of work on the Fraser. Has there been any thought about using a Ditson or any of the technology that is used in estimating the run size on the Fraser system? Maybe it wouldn't work there, but it seems to me there could be something better than a visual count.
Let him speak to historical.
It's been considered. The locks are a very loud place for hydroacoustics, and that's where a lot of the uncertainty is. It's easy to count fish through that window in the fish ladder. It's harder to walk along the edge of the locks and try to count schools as the locks close and boats move upstream. And we don't know how many fish are going back out the other way, as Aaron mentioned. If there was a easy spot to use some Ditsons and count fish upstream and downstream, we'd be doing it. But there's just not the spot to do that in that system.
Okay, that's and then you know, I know on the Fraser, I've come to learn that warm water and sockeye don't mix, and so I'm just wondering if there's been any. Look, examination of the productivity of Lake Washington stocks or lack of productivity in high water temperatures in Lake Washington.
I don't know that it's really been looked at from a productivity standpoint. It's definitely a concern during the adult migration.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sure. When the ship canal heats up in the summertime, it's very stressful on sockeye to move through that environment. As Aaron mentioned, we think a lot of fish move up into that environment and decide it's too warm and turn around and go back. It's a newer trend that we've seen this difference between the locks counts and what we see in the fishery and on the spawning grounds. Historically, we got a very good match between those two. The ship canal has been getting warmer over time, whether it's climate change, some other factor, I can't say. But that difference has gotten bigger over time, and a lot of people think it is due to not just mortality, but also us overcounting fish as they recycle through the system.
Okay, one more. What about predation? You know, is there a pike minnow population, increasing in pike minnow population, and eating up those little smolts? Is there any concern about that? Or
obviously, there are a lot of native and non-native predators in Lake Washington. Over the years, people pointed the finger at cutthroat, pike minnow, other things. The McPherson and Woody paper, their hypothesized mechanism was its smell in the early lake life history of sockeye fry. Whether it's direct predation by smelt or competition for a food resource, they couldn't say. Part of the reason they believe that is because we see a very different productivity in even in odd years, and smelt have a cyclical every other year life history. So that's one of the more recent hypotheses for what's a predation or competition mechanism that's limiting lake productivity.
So there's no phenomenon like Cultus Lake, you know, where they have that big problem with pike minnow. Okay, good. Okay, that's all I had. Thanks.
Thanks. Commissioner Schmitten?
Sure, I'll hurry. I'd like to just fill in some of the blanks on the high seas intercept fishery. Actually occurred on my watch about 1988-89 with Coast Guard overflights. We started getting reports, some photographs, that there was a lot of activity, most of the vessels coming on Taiwan, some out of China. These are nets that were in the neighborhood of 12 to 22 miles, and they would string them at night, pick them up in the day, string them at night. So we put an undercover operation together in 1990. It was the first time we had buy money. I had to sign for $250,000 in a suitcase to hand to these people in organizing a buy. A little frightening. From that, a coordinated effort was made to seize, and they did seize one or two vessels, immediately chased one all the way across the Pacific, finally got it. And we had 300,000 fish that we seized. That's a lot of fish. In fact, it became part of the oral arguments in the court in that we could see these fish deteriorating in value. So what we were proposing is, you know, take the fish off the table, win or lose in court, at least save the fish. The attorneys representing the defendants would not agree to that. There was also a subset that many fish dumped on the market at one time could affect the market value in a little area like this. So, but that didn't hold. What held is the court then would not allow the fish to be released. They all spoiled, and we buried them, which was a sad outcome. But the good side, you think that Congress can act. 6 months we had a national ban on high seas drift nets. 1 year, the UN passed a high seas drift net ban. So, Larry, occasional rumors as I hang around with some of the Fed guys that there may be some coming on, but it's nowhere near as organized, as widespread as it was. So I don't think that's a factor. I think high seas productivity is more the key that we got to solve, in my view.
Great. Really, really excellent job.
Thank you so much.
So let's move on and go to the public input portion of the agenda item. We've got a number of people who've signed up, and to review the commission testimony rules again real quickly, we offer citizens 3 minutes to testify. Come and sit at the front table. You don't have to be too close to the mic, just maybe 4 or 5 inches from the mic, and you'll be given 3 minutes. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up, and we'd like you to conclude your remarks. So I hope you'll cooperate with that, and I'll call you up two at a time. Spencer Ewing, please come forward, and Carl Carver. Okay, Mr.
Yu. Madam Chair, Commission, Director, I'd like to thank you, first of all, for having me up here today. I'd like to talk a little bit about my sockeye experience. I've fished all for Washington fisheries with my grandfather, Frank Yerbeck. I've fished Lake Washington, Wenatchee, Brewster, and Baker Lake. And the thing for me is each fishery has something special about it, whether it's Brewster and the 90-degree temperatures and the sun's out, or it's fishing Baker Lake in the midst of Mount Baker, or if it's Lake Washington, being in the urban environment. And in 2006, the Blue Angels flew so close over our head, we can make out the pilot's figure in the cockpit. So it's just a great experience. A lot of people get out for it. Some people who, you know, aren't for the, you know, Chinook fishery out in the ocean where you get salt all over you and you possibly get sick on the side of the boat. It just provides an opportunity for a lot of the other fishermen to get out. And I'd just like to say, for, as far as Lake Washington goes, I haven't seen a fishery since 2006, but I see that there's been work done with this new Cedar River hatchery, and I'd like to see that fully utilized, and hopefully I can get out again with my grandfather. Thank you.
Great job. Thank you. Steve Carver, please come forward. Okay. Mr. Carver?
Yes. Madam Chair, Director, and Commission, my name is Carl Carver, and I'm the president of the Auburn Save Our Fish chapter of Puget Sound Anglers. And basically, I'm speaking on behalf of our board of directors and our membership. I've got a lot of feedback on the Lake Washington sockeye fishery. And kind of to summarize our major concerns is we feel that there's been a lot of studying going on. The threshold of 350,000 hasn't been changed since the 70s, and we really feel there needs to be a recreational fishery, and that the hatchery, that the fish are, they're Baker fish, Baker River's fish, it's not a native run, so it shouldn't be managed as a native fishery. So that was one of the things that they wanted me to speak about. Also, let's see here, third. Yeah, talked about the threshold. We want to use the full capacity of the hatchery. Make sure we put, you know, millions of dollars into the hatchery, and we need to utilize it to its fullest capacity so that we're getting a return on investment. And again, to emphasize the fact that our membership wants a recreational fishery. There's no reason not to lower that threshold, probably down to somewhere around 150,000. As Mr. Macon, I believe, or spoke earlier about this threshold, it's not consistent with other systems. And, you know, we need to make some changes, cause and effect, make some bigger changes. And let's see, they've been studying this stuff for years. I've been hearing these same testimonies, and they study it and study it. And I work for a large corporation. There's a point where do some trial and error. Let's make some kind of significant changes here and see what the impacts are and then adjust accordingly. But just keep studying, and I don't know, I have concerns there. And I'm not sure about the subsistence fishery by the tribes. I know that there isn't a real good monitoring of that process, and I know I'm sure they're not impacting it too much, but I do believe there is some impact there if they're in their fishing on their subsistence fishery, because I don't believe it's being monitored and accurately recorded. So,
thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve Carver and Russell Carver, please come forward. Keep saying Mr. Carver. Mr. Carver. Are you all related?
Yes, we're all brothers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, okay. And
Mr.
Commission.
Carver.
I kind of got a call yesterday and said we needed some more support. And I'm basically coming in as just, you know, our family's been fishing the waters for years. And the impact that we're seeing, you know, with our, I want my children, their children to be able to fish. And with the changes that you've made, I can see that we're making great growth in the gill netting and things that are going on in our waters. And it's like Lake Washington, you know, prior to 2006, we could fish for the sockeye. And it was really important to our family, you know, when we would have, like, family get-togethers. One of the most important parts about the barbecues and whatever is the Carver boys, you know, you got to be bringing your salmon. Well, guess what? We can't fish Lake Washington anymore. We don't have those pretty red salmon to put on the barbecue. Well, it's a great impact to our family, you know, because, I mean, we do 4th of July, and, I mean, you can go on to all the different get-togethers, and, you know, they really kind of depended on us boys to, one of us would be fishing somewhere to bring some fish back. Well, to me, when I look at what I've looked at so far here, I'm a businessman. I own a steel fabricating company, and I have for years. And to me, when CCA came about, we've made a lot of changes with CCA. I belong to Save Our Fish and a lot of different Puget Sound anglers, and I kind of like to get involved with that stuff. I don't get to a lot of their meetings. I donate a lot of money to help impact what goes on with our fisheries, because I want our families to be able to, you know, fish along like we did when we were younger. I mean, we were fishing everywhere almost every day with my dad and uncles, and even our aunts would take us a lot of times fishing. You know, when the uncles were working, the aunts would take us and we'd go fishing. I mean, to me it's very important as a family. You get together with your dad and whatever, there's a lot of camaraderie. We can sit in the boat and you fish and you reminisce. And I mean, to me it's very important. And when I see the amount that you want us to meet, like on Lake Washington with 350,000 fish, I think it's way large. You know, we need to drop that down so that we can get back in there and get to fishing. I think it's very important to, you know, like the economy and whatever. Us as anglers, we put a lot of money into the system to see us not be able to get out there and fish in some of these fisheries that we used to fish, I think is very impacting on us as a family. And thank you for your time, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Carver?
Yeah. Thank you for the commission, for all you guys do and all your time that you put in. And, I mean, to hear all your questions back to the...
Sorry about that. Wasn't yours.
To hear all the questions come back from the commission to the different speakers, I really appreciate your thought behind everything that goes into it. Sitting back there, it's a lot of the questions that I would have asked too. And I basically want to speak on the Lake Washington fishery. I've been fortunate enough to fish every opening that's ever been on Lake Washington, and it's a great family fishery, and it's great for the large population area like we're in. To have that fishery open, its economic value to the state is phenomenal, and it's just easy for us not to spend the big dollars to go to Wenatchee or, you know, go farther out in the state now to catch the sockeye. I do a lot of kokanee fishing in the lakes, and I'm thankful for the sockeye or the kokanee in the lakes also. But speaking on basically Lake Washington, I think the threshold is way too high. I'd like to see us experiment with a lower threshold for a while, and then if the impact is too great, then, you know, we can always go back up. But I honestly think myself that the high seas fishery had a great impact when those people were caught out there. It changed the whole thing, and I think that's why we're seeing the sockeye numbers come up now, is because of what happened out on the high seas fishery. And I think another thing that affects the fisheries for the sockeye is what they're feeding on out in the oceans when they do get out there. Some of the people that I talk to that fish the ocean fishery, they're saying there's a lot more cannery boats out there fishing on the bait fish, not the herring so much, but the anchovies and stuff that are out there. When you see those, the impact on the anchovies and the herring increase, then it just leaves more feed for the sockeye out there in the ocean to feed on. And I think that's another factor right now why the sockeye fishery is doing a lot better right now. But I really would like to see that Cedar River hatchery brought up to its maximum capacity. And maybe for the state to do more studies on Lake Washington, you know, and see exactly, you know, what we can and can't do there. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Frank Urbeck and John Calvo.
Hi, my name is John Calvo. It's actually really an honor to be here today. I've read about all your names for years and years, and I've met Mr. Carpenter before. And to be honest with you, I thought you guys were both heroes and villains. And I've really learned a lot today. I was asked to come here a couple days ago by Mike Coombs, who owns Outdoor Emporium, where I work. It's kind of like my semi-retirement job. And I quickly realized I didn't want to come here to talk about economic values of fish and what have you, because you all know that. In fact, from what I've learned today, you guys know an awful lot, and I'm appreciative of that, because every day I have people, hundreds of people come in, and why can't we fish this, why can't we fish that? And my attitude basically is because we need to protect the fish. The fish come first, the survival of fish, and I certainly am seeing that again today, and I'll parlay that onto the customers I see every day. So instead of talking about Outdoor Emporium and the economical value of fish, first of all, I'm just going to talk about myself for a little bit. I'm a member of the Lake Washington chapter of Puget Sound Anglers, and some of you might remember names like Bill McKay, Jack Ballard, Dr. Chuck Wishman, and others. These are guys that when I joined the Lake Washington chapter in 1984, were already working on the possibility of a hatchery. And sad to say that with the exception of Dr. Chuck Wishman, the rest, Jack Ballard and everybody else have passed. But these guys, I'm here for these guys. These guys work really, really hard, and I really, really admire them an awful lot. I'm also a member of the Pogies Club of Seattle. So me personally, I grew up on Lake Washington, Seward Park, born in 1951, which makes me 62. I fish Lake Washington 40 times a year. I've spoken this last year to six different clubs, from Puget Sound Anglers to the Pogies to the Eastside Steelhead Chapter. A lot of people consider me to be one of the experts on Lake Washington as far as fishing. It's just something I grew up with. I've been fishing a lot, even just the last couple of weeks. Done extremely well. My main love is sockeye, but there's no sockeye fishery. So I've transported that over to refining myself to be a really good cutthroat fisherman. And I've chaired the last 5 years a cutthroat derby on Lake Washington. We had 98 participants this year. It was fully legitimate, legalized a derby. We picked up about 45 nice cutthroats that people entered. And I've had the opportunity myself to win it three times in the last 5 years. Didn't do too good this year, but I'm watching the lake. I grew up in Seward Park. I moved down to Renton on the lake. When I got married, I lived in Leschi. I now live half a mile from Newport Marina in Bellevue Side. And, you know, I just want to say there's a lot of feed going on in the lake. When I open up those cutthroats, I see a tremendous amount of sticklebacks. I see the mysis shrimp in the lake, and it's my goal this next year to establish a pike minnow derby on the lake, and our club is willing to sponsor it. We're putting a considerable amount of money into promoting the Lake Washington fishery, and sure hope to see the escapement goal come down, because with this new hatchery, there's no need for 350,000 fish in the lake. And just finish off by saying I've caught sockeye in the lake from April all the way to January. As I say, I'm out there about 40 days a year. So if you ever want to know anything about cutthroat fishing, get a hold of me at Outdoor Emporium. Thank you. And I've met you before. Thank you very much.
Okay, Doug Williams. Doug Williams, would you come forward?
Okay, I'll just go ahead. I will not be repeating what I said earlier. I just want to emphasize that to the commission and the director that the department is deeply involved in the Lake Washington sockeye thing. And the success or failure in terms of getting back to a fishery in large measure depends on the department. The co-managers are a big part of the harvest thing and the new escapement goal. There's discussions underway. It's been in the papers. I'm directly involved in having some discussions right now with those from the department that have developed some criteria, and we're still debating some of that. There's also a study proposal that I've been working on with Eric Netherland and Jim Scott and the University of Washington professor regarding looking at the predation. And according to the University of Washington, Dave Bocamp, that we lose 94% to 99% of the fry. They don't make it to smolt. And so we're looking at a proposal that would maybe tie that down to give us a technical basis, perhaps, to take some action. And as you know, in other lakes, Idaho, even this state here, people are now starting to look at removing some of the large predators. But we got to be on a strong factual basis. So that's underway, and I'm involved with that discussion. You know, the department's involved with running the hatchery. They're contractors to the city of Seattle on that. They're contractors with regard to doing the measurement of the fry, fry-out migration. In other words, the data, developing the data in so many ways. And in the key committee, there's parties to the Landsberg Mitigation Agreement. Bob Everett sits on that, and that's like a veto power. Those are the people that make the final decisions. I'm on an adaptive management work group. The department has representatives of the tribes too. We make recommendations, and I've been at this. I go clear back to the 70s when I was with the Corps of Engineers trying to figure out how we can increase sockeye production. So I just want to emphasize, you folks really have a key responsibility here. And my job is to hold your feet to the fire, and I try to do that as best I can. And so let's, as a partnership, let's get us back fishing again. We can address the issues and have success, and it's just good for everybody. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And Mr. Williams.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. There's a lot of people here that know a lot more about sockeye than I do. I just wanted to come up and just representing my two sons, myself, my brother, and numerous friends that like to get out and fish for the sockeye when we've been able to. And I'm addressing Lake Washington. I've got a son that's 22, and he's been out with me, and he's really enjoyed. So he's not a big fisherman, but when we went out sockeye fishing, that really got him going. I've got a 10-year-old son who was with me. He was 3 years old when he went out the last time in 2006, so he doesn't remember that. But I tell him about it, and he wants to go. So I'm really looking forward to the day that we can look at graphs like these two gentlemen had, where it seemed like all of the sockeye fisheries in the state the last 3 years since 2010 have had these nice spikes. I want to see that for Lake Washington as well, so that we can consistently get out there and fish. Because I consider the Lake Washington sockeye fishery kind of the Super Bowl of Washington salmon fishing. There's no excitement like it with any other salmon fishing that I've ever noticed. When dates are announced for that, it's just it's lights out. Everybody's crazy about it. But I too would like to see that the threshold of 350,000 fish. It doesn't. I've never heard any scientific backing to that, and I'd really like to see that number drop, if for no other reason than to allow the fishermen to get out and do it, but also to see what impacts that has to lower it to say 200 or 150,000. What are we seeing? That's kind of my main thing, was I just wanted to see that number dropped and to continue to support what's going on in the Cedar River hatchery and anything that's holding back the maximum production, since that is it's not a natural return, to allow that as maximum production for that hatchery as possible. Because I appreciate everybody that's done everything to get that up and going. So I'm really anticipating good things coming up soon. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Really very positive statements from the public. We're enthusiastic. You've seen. We've got an enthusiastic set of commissioners here. So we'll see what we can do about this. Thank you all. We've reached a break.